The following episode of the Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
One of the 10 best films of the year. A high-octane mixture of outlandishly stylized camp and outrageously sensational shootouts. Outrageously exhilarating, guaranteed to tingle the most jaded moviegoer's palate. The killer is great cinema. Film concocted with nitroglycerin, the combined energy of the Road Warrior, RoboCop, and the Terminator.
Welcome to another blood-soaked episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
Hey, call me Dumbo, and you're Mickey Mouse, remember?
I'd rather call you that than Shrimp Head. This week, we're looking at John Woo's classic heroic bloodshed film, The Killer. Made in 1989, the film redefined the action genre, not only in its native Hong Kong, but globally. The film stars Chow Yun-fat as Ah Zhong, or Jeff. I won't say he's an assassin with a heart of gold. Rather, he's a killer with a code of honor. He's pursued by Danny Lee as Lee, a hot-handed super cop who chafes under police politics and find that his way of thinking is a lot like Jeff's. Between the two men is Sally Ye as Jenny, a chanteuse who Jeff accidentally blinds. Jeff decides to do just one more job in order to fund an operation for Jenny, and that's when Jeff finds that the world is changing, leaving him and Honor in the past. That's the quick version of the story. I'm sure we're going to be going into it much more as we go along, and I'm sure there's going to be tons of spoilers. So hopefully you've seen The Killer, and if not, we can wait.
As we talked about on last week's show, you know, Mike and I actually got the chance to check out The Killer on the big screen here in Detroit. You know, I know we didn't talk about it too much post-screening, but just how bad was the guy who introduced the film? I mean, I just don't think he got it, you know, and his whole comment about the homoeroticism of The Killer, come on.
I know you don't see it, but I can kind of see where he's coming from, because I know that Wu's been accused of that that stuff in the past. And frankly, I don't hold to the theory, but it does present a very interesting read on the film.
It isn't there. Again, it all goes back to rule one of criticism and theory. And again, anyone with their head not up their anus knows, in attempt to theorize, you always have to have your facts and your proof slash evidence to confirm your theory. So show me the interview with John Woo where he says, yeah, that was my intent. They are interested in each other sexually. Bullshit. Hey, Mike, I'm glad we're friends. I'm glad we both like the same things. We have that in common. So yeah, let's fuck. I mean, come on. You know, anyone that could write that or claim that or attempt to put their bull hockey theories on people's minds about any sort of homoeroticism in the films of John Woo, they're just really late in themselves. You know, and I think this goes back to that crap that Simon Callow wrote about Orson Welles in volume one of his biography, where he claimed Welles was gay. You know, just because you want someone to be gay doesn't mean that you are. And, you know, there certainly isn't anything wrong with it, of course, but to take that stance and purpose, that theory to me is just cheap. You know, it shows me an extreme lack of, like, daring thought about the material. You know, what's next? Richie wants to rail the fucking Fonz because they had respect for each other? I mean, these fucking characters in The Killer, they respect and admire each other, you know, for varied reasons. There's a kinship there, too, you know, because at the end of the day, they aren't that different from each other. And that doesn't mean that they want to get into each other's butts. You know, such a fucking stupid theory.
Richie, first off, is a total bottom. So I don't think that Wu has ever said that it's intentional, that they're, you know, oh yeah, I definitely wanted this. And I don't think culturally that is where he's coming from, but I think it's the right of anybody to read a film a different way. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure that there are a lot of filmmakers who put stuff in their films and they don't realize that folks can read them in a different way. You know, it could be a misinterpretation, but it's, you know, I thought it was a fair interpretation of what it was. And the guy didn't really have that long to actually stand up there and be like, yeah, well, there's homoeroticism in these films and this and that and the other thing. And plus, he didn't really say that there was homoeroticism in The Killer necessarily, but he was saying that there have been attempted remakes and that a Western audience would see that kind of a friendship as being kind of homoerotic. And again, I don't know whether I hold to that or not, but I just, you know, that was the guy interpreting it. Or, you know, actually it felt like the guy was just kind of parroting something he had already read someplace else. You know, he's like, he's dropping Jean-Pierre Melville, but he's not really like backing it up and saying why there are influences of Jean-Pierre Melville in these films. But whatever, the guy had a 5-minute intro, even though it felt like 15 because it was pretty damn boring.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, ultimately that's just my problem with that guy is, you know, you go to these screenings and you think this guy is the expert, you know, and he's portrayed that way, like, this is such and such film professor from here. It's like, and that, I just have a real problem with that because he should have said that then. You know, he should have said, like, look, this is my interpretation, or I'm just recycling information for you. Like, because then in theory, you're just filling people's heads with crap, and this doesn't even necessarily mean it's true, but some people might take it as fact, and I find that really offensive.
I feel bad that we just keep saying this guy, because it's like, I don't remember what his name is. I mean, because I've seen him introduce a couple films now, and it's like, he did an okay job with Throne of Blood when I went to see that there, but yeah, his intro for The Killer just wasn't all that. I mean, it was like, he wasn't excited about this film, and that's what this film kind of demands, is really that you get excited about it. It was such a revolutionary film when it came out. It's changed everything as far as the action genre. You know, it's like there was the whole 80s action stuff, which America was just really, you know, we were like experts on action films in the 80s. You know, I mean, that was the prime time for Schwarzenegger and Van Damme and all these guys. And meanwhile, you've got like the Hong Kong folks, and they're seeing all these things coming in. They're seeing all these movies from the past and all this stuff kind of hitting them, and they're reinterpreting it into their own way. Well, you've even got like French action films like La Femme Nikita coming over and being reinterpreted into like The Black Cat and stuff. So it was just like, some people accuse the Hong Kong filmmakers of being ripoff artists, you know, kind of the same way that some folks accuse a lot of the Indian filmmakers of being ripoff artists. But for me, they're just kind of taking what they want and then kind of pushing out the rest. You know, I can see definitely a lot more plagiarism in the Indian stuff than I can in the Hong Kong stuff, even though there are a lot of similar things here and there. And the same way America was taking from Hong Kong a little bit, not a whole lot at that point, but there are scenes in like Tango and Cash that are like, oh, well, this came from Jackie Chan's police force, but wasn't like as blatant as it is now. I mean, we'll talk more about the direct descendants of the killer as we go along here, but the killer rewrote a lot of things and really spawned a lot of stuff. Let's dive right ahead on in here. The killer, for me, the thing that I like the most about it, other than the action, I like the way that everything is structured, and you've got the two stories going along, the story of the killer. I'll call him Jeff for this episode. Chow Yun-fat has gotten many different names depending on who's translating the film, but for me, he'll always be Jeff. And then the other character I will call Lee, even though his name in the film is Lee, L-I, but the guy that plays him, the actor, is Danny Lee, but some people call him Little Eagle because that's what his mentor calls him a few times. But speaking of gay,
when the killer is translated to Spanish, Jeff is jefe.
Yo tengo mucho dinero.
Right.
Para matar. Let's see. Okay, so in the middle, you've got Jenny, and then you've got Jeff and Lee, and then you've got what I find the most fascinating is then you've got their mentors. You know, you've got Sydney over on the killer's side, and you've got Chang over on Lee's side, and they're both there kind of like representing. Chang is like very even-tempered, great cop. You know, he's trying to do his best job. He's not nearly as hot-tempered as Lee is and stuff, and he tries to calm him down a few times, you know, he goes all out for the detective work. I mean, he literally sacrifices his life going after the answers to this case that they're on. And then you've got Sydney, who's the old school. I mean, you could consider him a knight if you wanted to. You know, he's tainted a little bit. He's got that the hand injury, so he's like he can't do what he used to be able to do. And that kind of sums up the whole. These guys want to do what they were able to do in the past, and they want to follow these codes and stuff, but there are forces at work that are keeping them from following these codes.
The killer is, for me, like Woo's most detailed film. Like, it's really strange because, like, you know, I love John Woo, but like I tend to fall in love with the extreme violence and, you know, the ballet of it, you know, and the killer is, it's sort of like, you know, the thinking man's action film in the sense that, you know, these characters have a lot of depth to them. And it's, I struggle with the fact that I don't like that in a Woo film, if that makes sense. Like that's why, like, my favorite Woo film is Hard Boiled. And it's just because it's so mindless and over the top and like gratuitous. And like, and so it's like, why I love the killer. It's like, I almost feel like it doesn't belong in it. Like, I like my Woo superficial, if that makes sense.
To me, it's the perfect blend of the melodrama that he had going on in A Better Tomorrow and the really balls out action that he had going on in Hard Boiled. Because there is that other level of Hard Boiled as far as, you know, like the emigration story, you know, the one guy making the paper cranes throughout the entire thing, you know, every time he kills somebody, he makes a paper crane for them, and then he lets all the cranes go at the end. And it's Woo's last film before he emigrates to the United States, and so he's just kind of putting the whole thing into perspective for him. Birds are just such a huge theme in that one, you know, how they meet at the tea house and they've got all the birds there, and, you know, and of course, you know, everybody laughs now when they think of John Woo, and he's always got those stupid white doves in the movies and stuff, you know. It's like now it's just ridiculous. I mean, now it has gotten, you know, I haven't seen Wind Talkers all the way through, and I haven't seen Red Cliffs yet either, because I just was kind of done with Woo after some of the American films that he made, especially I think Paycheck was the last one.
I liked Paycheck.
You liked Paycheck?
I did.
There was like the part in there where they're in like a scientific research lab and there are freaking doves flying around. And I'm like, what? What? That makes no sense at all.
Listen, you cannot go wrong with Affleck and Woo.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to that one because I thought, finally, here's the Johnny Paycheck story that I've been wanting to see for all these years. And John Woo is directing a biopic of him. But no, you know, as soon as it started and there was no take this job and shove it, I was like, oh, this is so wrong.
Take this job and shove it.
Love me some Paycheck. You know, going back to the Hard Boiled, it's like, it's not enough for me. Everything you mentioned is not enough for me. Like, I know what's coming in Hard Boiled, so it's like, you know, give me the scene at the jazz club and then the skip to the hospital. And that's what I like so much. And the killer sucks you in more on a different level in the sense that there's so much more of a story there. And you actually, you know, it's like in Hard Boiled, you don't really care that much about the characters. And then in Killer, you actually do care about the characters, which is what makes it so great, obviously. But I just have this weird internal struggle with Woo in the sense that I just love that action. was really funny about seeing the killer in the theater with you was the fact is that I've seen the killer like 20 times. And it's like I always have had this weird struggle with getting through it. Like I'm just like, I sit there and watch it and just like, man, this thing is really long. That's the power of the theater, though, because in the theater, I was so sucked in. And like, it's like I hadn't, it was really great seeing the theater because it was like seeing it for the first time again. Seeing the theater sort of gave me a little bit more respect for the killer. I mean, I know it's a classic and I do really like it, but you know, I don't look at it as a standalone film in the sense like, this is the killer. The killer will always be associated with John Woo for me. It's like, I can't disassociate a director from his work. And so it's like, I always think of John Woo, I think of Hard Boiled, I think of The Killer. So it's like you can't look at it as a standalone film. So for me, it was really great because I was able to look at it as a standalone film for the first time by seeing it in the theater.
If you were like me, probably saw a whole lot of Woo all at one time because it was just kind of like, it didn't come out in drips and drabs. Yeah. Because for me, it was like, you know, I went into class one day and my friend Mike Thompson was there and he was like, oh my God, I saw this movie. You have to see this. And he was trying to describe it to me. And I'm just like, this sounds too crazy. What you're telling me sounds insane. You know, he's telling me about that opening gunfight in the club, and which is great, you know, because that really, you're right, it does just suck you right in, man, because it's like you start real slow at that church and, you know, so meditative and got that beautiful Sally Ye song, and then bam, it's just huge violence right in your face, and it's just like, oh my God. What my friend described to me was the gun on the end of the table when Jeff is out of bullets and he sees the gun over there and he sees the guy with the shotgun coming up and he kicks the table and you get that, you know, slow-mo as the gun flies through the air and then like how he catches it three times, you know, that kind of quick cut that Woo became famous for. And my friend's like, this is the Evil Dead 2 of action films. Oh, get out of town, I have to see this now.
Groovy. What was funny about that scene, too, is when we saw it in the theater, people laughed during that scene. I was really surprised. Like, they thought that was funny that he did that. Or it was, like, almost, like, impossible. I'm like, I don't think it's funny. I think he could totally be done. What are you talking about?
You often talk about suspension of disbelief, and this is one of those where once you get into this film, you're just so into it. And I don't care that he never runs out of bullets. You know, it's like he can run out, you know, he can shoot 10,000 times, and it's like, okay, he's a samurai with a gun. It's beautiful work that Woo does directing the action. And I'm wondering if people laughed because that part is definitely so extreme, but also because now it's almost become a parody of itself because of all these action films that came after it. But seeing that for the first time was just absolute revelation, because Woo really revolutionized, you know, he was using a lot of the slow-mo, getting a lot of that from like Peckinpah. You know, there's that scene in The Wild Bunch where they shoot the guy and he's on top of the building and he starts to fall, and then you cut around to all this other action that's going on, then you cut back to that guy and he's like still falling, really showing you how shattered time is, and that this one instant is being stretched out to show you all these other things that are happening. And Woo is just perfect the way that he mixed all these different levels of fast forward and regular motion and just kind of blended them all together to really just turn up that action to just an extreme. And then again, those double and triple cuts that he would do where you see something from one angle and then you see it again from a slightly different, and then see it again from a slightly different one, like that scene with the dragon boat assassination where you see Jeff pick up that gun like four or five times and bring it up to his eye and then shoot Tony Wang. It's just like nobody had seen stuff like that, or if they had, they didn't see it in this context.
The camera's always moving, and he has two DPs on this film too, so a lot of the times the camera reminds you like that you're almost verite in the sense that the camera tends to be kind of fluttering behind whatever's on the screen, the actor who's shooting. The camera's kind of, it's almost like you're watching this weird documentary a little bit, some of those action sequences.
Yeah, I wonder if he had one DP doing the action scene and then one doing like the drama stuff. Then also this was kind of a longer shoot for a Hong Kong film, because I think they were kind of thrown together a little bit faster than this one. So it was like a big deal at the time that it took, I don't remember the exact amount of days to shoot, but it was like, you know, oh my gosh, the thing took 8 weeks. The thing, too, that I liked about this, so you've got the parallels between these four guys, and then you've got the total parallel going on between Jeff and Lee and just how similar they are to one another, and you're seeing them doing similar actions and stuff. And this stuff comes up again and again in Woo's films, just how similar the bad guy is to the good guy. And I love the scene where the camera is moving across and you see Jeff sitting in his chair smoking a cigarette, and then you cut as you go past and you see Lee sitting in the same chair, you know, almost the exact same pose. Then you cut again, you see Jeff, and you cut again, you see Lee, and it's just like, wow, this is nice. This is so nice.
Right. And you know what's really clever about that too is there's usually flashbacks done in Hollywood films. They're a little bit insulting because it's like, hey, stupid audience member, we're going to show you this so you remember this. But you know, and what I like about the flashbacks in The Killer is they're used not to remind you of something. They're used to put you in that character's head. So you're thinking what the character is thinking. So in that particular sequence, you know, you think Danny Lee is, there's that flashback of Jeff in the chair shooting the guy in the doorway. And then it cuts to Danny Lee seeing his partner in the doorway and he pulls the gun. That's really brilliant, you know, and you don't see that in Hollywood.
After we were done watching it at the DFT, I remember you talking about the clothes and just how their clothes change throughout it and really kind of reflect what they're doing. Jeff starts off completely in black, and then by the end of the film, he's in white, which is also great because then you get blood-stained white. And then you've got Lee through the whole thing, really kind of ambivalent and wearing stripes throughout almost the entire thing, which is very cool. And I'm trying to remember, I want to say like, well, first off, that striped outfit looks really silly to me a lot of times, but you know, those stripes change width and stuff too. So I think as the killer becomes one way, Lee becomes another, and they kind of meet in the middle someplace.
With Cheyenne Fat, like, you know, he starts out in black, and then in the next few scenes down, he's wearing gray, and then a few scenes down after that, he's wearing tan, and then the final, he's in bright white.
You know, we were talking about filmmakers that may accidentally put stuff into their films or may not think things all the way through. This one feels like Wu had thought about everything. Probably talk a little bit about the origin of the film, you know, because like this one for me is kind of the culmination of a whole bunch of ideas that Wu had been thinking about and studying for all these years and then finally put them into this film. He had done A Better Tomorrow. You know, he had been a director for, I don't know how many years, but he had been working for, say, at least 20 years and doing all these like melodramas and light family fare and some kung fu films and crazy comedies and all this kind of stuff. And then he really broke through with A Better Tomorrow, put him on the map like nobody's business, like this huge family melodrama thing, you know, triads. And that gave him the opportunity to really move forward and do what he wanted to do. And kind of got stuck in a little bit of a ghetto with like Better Tomorrow 2 because, you know, the first one made all kinds of money. And then he gets to do The Killer after that. When we were talking about doing this episode forever ago, because I've actually been thinking about doing this one for like 6 months now, I was like, hey, Justin, when I talk about this movie, I'm going to talk
about all these
other movies. But I think I gave you a list of like, I'm going to talk about all this stuff. So I don't know if you had a chance to see some of these things. But for me, The Killer really starts with A Gun for Hire, the Graham Greene book that was turned into This Gun for Hire. And have you ever seen that one?
No, I never saw that one.
It's really good. It's one of the first movies that Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake were in together. And Alan Ladd plays this killer for hire named Raven. Robert Preston, the guy from Victor Victoria and Last Starfighter.
And The Music Man.
And The Music Man, yes. He's in it as Veronica Lake's boyfriend / fiance. In the book, it's weird. Well, the book was British. It was Graham Greene, right? And I listened to a narrative version. And the way that the guy pronouncing the two guys' names, one was Raven and the other one was Mather, and said with a British accent, you're going to have to trust me on this, said with a British accent, they sounded very similar. And I think they realized this, the filmmakers, when they made this movie, because then they changed it, since it's an American movie, they changed it from Mather to Crane. So you still have these two guys with bird names going on in it. They're not necessarily as tied together as Lee and Jeff were, but there's definitely that the similarity between their names and that they're both birds. And you've got Veronica Lake right in the middle of these two guys and just their kind of struggle. But yeah, I highly recommend it. And then I found this out just the other day, and I watched this one. Was James Cagney. I never knew this, but James Cagney actually directed a film. One film. He directed a remake of This Gun for Hire called Shortcut to Hell. I guess it was kind of a troubled production a little bit, and you know, that's maybe why he never directed another one. But watching that one, you really appreciate Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake. And then there's another one called Nezuro Mano, this Teruro Ishii films, apologies to my Japanese friends if I have any, with Ken Takatura in it. And that one's interesting too. It's a Yakuza film, and it's about this killer who goes to another country and talking about the divide between the law and the killer. That one's interesting interesting because it plays a lot with language. So you've got the killer is Japanese, so he's always, you know, speaking Japanese, and people that he speaks Chinese to can always tell that he's speaking Chinese, you know, like with a Japanese accent and stuff. So it's really neat to watch that movie, and it's actually very difficult to watch that movie because they've got two sets of subtitles in it. Subtitles in, I think it's in white when he's speaking Japanese and in yellow when he's speaking Chinese. And it's just like, okay, if you're not paying real strict attention, you're going to lose what the hell's going on and like who he's talking to in what language.
Nice.
It's not the easiest one. But I think the one movie that everybody focuses in on when they talk about the killer and where it came from was Jean-Pierre Melville's Les Samurai.
Right.
Have you had a chance to see that one?
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Not a huge fan of Melville, so.
I like Melville a lot. I like Red Circle. I love Bob Le Flambeur. I love Le Dulos. But I didn't really care about Les Samurai. It was so slow and so meditative. It's funny because I can see a lot of the story coming from Les Samurai and going into the killer. You know, it starts off very similar. You know, this killer going through this club, and there's this woman singing this song. He knocks on the door, he goes in, and instead of that, like, bam, balls out action thing I was talking about before, it's just so slow, and they're talking to each other.
Qui êtes-vous? Aucune importance. Que voulez-vous? Vous tuez.
Funny because in so many other Melville films, there is that cop-killer relationship, and there's that like banter between them, like Bob Le Flambeur, like he's got this cop that he talks to. Same thing with Les Dulos, and even in like The Second Breath, there's a lot of conversation between, you know, and I really see this kind of like leading into like some of Michael Mann's films, you know, but Melville does it a lot better. Wu does it a lot better than Michael Mann, I'm sorry to say. I know that just ruined our chances for a Manhunter episode sometime, but yeah, Les Samurai, it was a snooze fest. I mean, it looked pretty and stuff, but I'm going to have to rewatch it. It was just really, really slow for me. And so, yeah, it was like Les Samurai with like incredible action scenes is what the killer.
Yeah. And then, you know, the thing about the style and the hats and stuff, that just ultimately just ties into film noir anyway, is when it comes down to it, you know? So you could say that it comes from Les Samurai, but really, I think that whole thing just comes from film noir anyways.
Melville was definitely recycling film noir, but he was putting on his own stuff into it, and he was really injecting a lot more style into it. I think he was making it cooler than it was, you know, because for me, real film noir is very rough and tumble, and you know, a lot of hard edges. Melville really took all the hard edges and smoothed those down and really made like this polished gangster film. I don't know, I could be thinking the wrong way, but for me, he had the cool style, whereas the other filmmakers had more of a by the seat of their pants kind of style. I mean, Hawks had tons of style, don't get me wrong, and a lot of these filmmakers had a lot of style, but I think the filmmaking conditions were such that they were really just like, let's get this done, let's churn it out, you know, next movie, let's go, you know. And sometimes I think that's maybe where some of these happy accidents kind of take place, but I don't sure. I know I'm just kind of digging my own.
Well, yeah, but it comes down to just simple simple technique too, you know, like the lighting can solve a lot of problems fast.
Yeah, that's true. Even going back to This Gun for Hire, there were a lot of cool shots in that. You know, there were some scenes of them going into like this shack out by this factory and in the train yards and all this kind of stuff. And it felt like a big movie, even though I knew it was a very small budgeted. So I definitely saw a lot of Les Samurai in this. And then some of the still frames that he used, especially at the end, like when they're in the church and Lee and Jeff are talking to each other and they both freeze, like one freezes and then the other one says something and then
right.
freezes. Totally reminded me of Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, that and like Truffaut as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's a good point. Very good point. We were talking earlier about the films that came after The Killer. And, you know, we should probably put this into a little bit of context, like, because I know, like, you know, you have turned me on to a lot of good films from the 80s. And like I said, the 80s to me were like, that's where action films, you know, that's where American action films, I should say, were really just like, we had the market cornered on that stuff. I mean, like Commando.
Let off some steam, Bennett.
Red Scorpion. Seeing The Killer, it was such a marked difference. difference, at least for me, compared to where we were going in the 80s with these action films. And you know, it's not fair. I'm leaving out Sylvester Stallone because he was making a lot of good action films as well. So comparing this to like Cobra or Tango and Cash and stuff, comparing this to that, I mean, it's a night and day to me. I don't know about for you.
They're just different in the sense that there's just more characterization in the Hong Kong stuff versus the American stuff. Like, you know, even at that point, Stallone and Schwarzenegger delivering one-liners. Lundgren's delivering one-liners. Chuck Norris is kind of delivering a lot of one-liners. You know, there was just no substance ultimately is what it came down to. Like, even if you look back at something like Commando, it's just one-liners and great segues, you know, great action things, and then there's some silence and some great action. Doesn't mean it's a bad movie, but no. I mean, compared to something like The Killer, I mean, The Killer is no, you know, it's not like Shakespeare or something. I mean, it's pretty light and fluffy still for even the substance it has. But I mean, I think there's a huge difference there. But I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that our films were going into decline.
In his explosive motion picture debut, Jeff Speakman is the perfect weapon.
It's like we were peaking and then, you know, Demolition Man kind of marks the downslope. Because then at that point, you get really, really, really superficial and fluffy. They just get bad, too. Like, so in America, so many bad action movies. Like, I mean, I can't even imagine if you're a fan of Demolition Man.
I do like Demolition Man, even though I am still trying to figure out the three seashells.
He doesn't know how to use the three seashells.
Demolition Man, 1993. The Killers came out in 89 in Hong Kong. It really started to get its traction here in 90. I think it played the Sundance Film Festival in January of 1990, and that's where it's, you know, really started to kind of pick up steam after that, and they started to have different little pocket screenings going on around the country. As far as I know, and somebody can correct me on this one, I don't think it ever opened wide. I think it was definitely a art house thing. For me, it was a word of mouth thing, and for me also it was I think it was really until it got out on Laserdisc before I really even heard about it or saw it, you know, and it was like, it wasn't even one of these movie passed from fan to fan kind of thing. It was just, I don't even know where it came from the first time, other than my friend Mike telling me about it.
You're forgetting something very important, and as much as you're going to hate to admit it, your friend was the one that kind of popularized this film, because I don't think this film would have got as well known had it not been for Quentin Tarantino mentioning it, you know, and in his using the two guns in Reservoir Dogs. I think ultimately that's where you start to see it, because The Killer comes into American culture at that point. To be honest with you, I probably would have never saw The Killer had it not been for Tarantino mentioning anything about it.
I think you're probably right, and I know that I had seen The Killer probably post. And yeah, the two things did kind of go hand in hand. And it was really at that point where Hong Kong movies started to explode and where people started to show an interest. So I guess this is, I'm thinking, what, 92, 93 is where this stuff came into play.
Remember that quote-unquote professor at the screening? He actually said, he said, oh, it came into the mainstream consciousness of Americans in 1992. And I'm like, well, I mean, yeah, but it didn't come out in America in 92. It came out like in 90, but 92 is when Tarantino mentioned it. And then, you know, you had the double two for VHSs for sale of Hard Boiled and The Killer that you could buy just like that overnight, you know. Good or bad is ultimately what it comes down to, is Tarantino has helped people in that sense that he's, you know, tried to introduce films to American culture.
Yeah, definitely. And it's kind of ironic, since Danny Lee and Chow Yun-fat, the two stars of this, were the two stars of City on Fire, which Tarantino might have seen before he made Reservoir Dogs.
Maybe. No, he didn't see that.
This is really when it starts to saturate. By 93, with Demolition Man, you've already got the first instance of people really taking that style. I mean, because even though, you know, you've got the two-gun thing and Reservoir Dogs, you didn't see the slow-mo and the cross-cutting and all that kind of stuff. You saw it in Demolition Man. As I'm watching that film, and you see Sylvester Stallone flying through the air, shooting two guns at Wesley Snipes, and I'm just like, wow, Hong Kong has arrived in the United States and is right there on screen. Throughout the 90s, you really started to get a whole lot more of those, and you got a really, just a whole lot of bad copies.
You gotta think about it, they're so bad now that I seriously have a hard time telling things apart, you know, like that all kind of blends in, especially like any of the Jason Statham movies, they're all kind of blending for me. Like, I couldn't even tell you, like, if you put one on, I probably couldn't tell you what it was called, because they're all just kind of the same thing, you know? I mean, if anything, that's a testament to John Woo, you know? If anything, Woo's mark is the double gun. That doesn't say much, but if anything, his mark on American culture is the use of the double gun.
Well, then even in like A Low Down Dirty Shame, the Keenan Ivy Wayans movie, I remember at one point, some guys, I think it was one of the henchmen's like,
I'm Chow Young Fat. Do you know what that means?
Yeah, you come with an egg roll and miso soup.
And I'm like, what?
Listen, that raises a point because last week we covered Big Wednesday and it was the first time you had seen it. But yeah, you found some time somehow to watch Low Down Dirty Shame.
This is not me watching Low Down Dirty Shame. This is me remembering Low Down Dirty Shame from when I saw it in the theater.
On the theater?
I saw it in the theater. So there were just so many bad ripoffs. I remember like Marky Mark was in one of the ripoff movies, like The Big Hit or something. And
The Big Hit, right.
Yeah, and I want to say there was like staircase sequence from Hard Boiled was kind of being taken in that. So now really it's become a cliche, and it's unfortunate that a lot of these things that were so revolutionary in The Killer have just become a cliche over the years. And now, you know, anytime you see somebody and they're really, you know, shooting up the place, you see in that slow-mo. I think the worst, well, I won't call them the worst offenders, because I actually, you know, and I think we've talked about this before, I love the first Matrix movie, and I think that Wachowski brothers did it right in that movie by taking a lot of the Hong Kong stuff. I mean, they had like Yuen Woo-ping doing the action sequences, the kung fu. I think that it had to have been Joe Bob Briggs who popularized the term gun-fu. Any of those films, those post-90 films where they're doing any of those kind of like crazy gun things, you know, kicking the magazine up into the gun with their heel and all those kind of things.
Absolutely.
I think they all fit under the gun-fu thing. And I think that The Matrix is like the American culmination of gun-fu was in that film. And fortunately, they couldn't keep it up. And I think that's really where the other Matrix movies failed, is they didn't have that fun that was going on in the first movie, because there were so many great set pieces in that film, you know, and there was like literal gung fu where they're flying through the air and shooting at each other and all that kind of stuff, which was just awesome.
I hate The Matrix.
Really? You hate the first one even?
I hate them all, yeah.
It's still a favorite of mine. But I think the guys who did a disservice to Woo, the Pang brothers from Thailand, who made Bangkok Dangerous. And this one, I don't know if you've ever tried to make it through this movie. I think I've made it through 10 minutes of this film. Actually, I think they made it twice.
No, I've never seen it. No, I never had a desire to see it, actually.
It's bad.
I'm not a Nick Cage fan. Maybe I'll seek out the original, but yeah, anything with Nicolas Cage, I'm not a fan of.
You know, I've actually seen more of the remake with Nick Cage than I saw of the original, because the original is just so bad. Well, the original, you know, in The Killer, Jenny is the blind girl, and in Bangkok Dangerous, the killer actually is, I'm not sure if he's mute and deaf, but he's definitely mute. I think he might be deaf as well. And it's like, okay, that's really weird that they would do that. And then in the remake, you know, Nick Cage isn't mute or deaf or anything. He's Nick Cage, which I guess is his own handicap to live with. The one thing that they're playing with in the original, and they took it out. But yeah, even in like the first 5 minutes, like that scene on the beach in The Killer, where you see the little girl who happens to catch a glimpse, the glint off of one of the gunmen's sights or whatever. Yeah, that same thing almost happens in the beginning of Bangkok Dangerous, and it's like, you gotta be kidding me.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
It hurts, man. It really hurts. But yeah, you know, so I'd say that Tarantino is definitely influenced. You're definitely right on that one. Then I would say that probably Robert Rodriguez wouldn't have a career if it weren't for John Woo and some of the stuff that he was doing. I think he really took a lot of stuff from that.
Oh, absolutely. I agree completely. I used to be like a pretty big fan of Rodriguez. Like, you know, I was a really big fan of El Mariachi when it came out. And I really liked Desperado. And then I really liked From Dusk Till Dawn. And then at that point is when he lost me. I gave up on Rodriguez after From Dusk Till Dawn. I don't like the cowboy hat.
Cowboy hat's got to go.
He wrote that book back in the 90s, and that was really great. And the thing about The Killer is, I think you, with all your talking, you have totally proven that the film had this huge impact on American film culture. And so, I mean, I don't think that there's anything to dispute. Like, it is a great film, and I can't imagine that there's anyone out there listening that hasn't seen it at least 3 or 4 times. You know, that maybe that professor at the screening should watch it a few more times.
You know, I'm hoping that there are folks that haven't seen it, and I hope that they anybody will check it out and everything. It's fairly readily available. I was trying to count how many times it's been released on DVD, and the word innumerable came to mind. But I would be very curious to get somebody's take on it who is seeing it for the first time, having grown up with all of these films now. You know, it's, you know,
yeah, right.
But they'd look back at it and be like, what? Everybody does this, you know, or because there is that the melodrama stuff, you know, that
sure.
that could really turn people off.
It's not that dramatic, though. I mean, I don't think so. I think it's within reason. I mean, I think if anything, I mean, there's some overly dramatic things, but I think that just has to do with the barrier of culture. Like, you know, there's that, there's the music, and then there's that, you know, scene where I think Jeff is kissing Jenny on the head, you know, and he's like, it's almost like they're acting for silent film, you know, they've got to overdo it, you know, for the camera. So, I mean, but ultimately, I don't think that's any, that's a small point. Like, there's not even really any reason to mention it whatsoever. I think it's perfect. I think it's a perfect movie. But like I said, for me, I like my woo a little more violent. So, and the story plays a little backseat for that for me.
Let's go ahead and we'll take a break and we'll play back the interview I did with Professor Ken Hall, the guy who wrote the book on John Woo. I have to say, how did a professor of Spanish get involved with Asian cinema?
I was always like a Japanese film fan, you know, for years and years. And my dissertation actually had to do with film and narrative. So I've always been sort of a film buff, I suppose. And then I started working professionally, you know, academically, with topics on film and narrative. Basically, what happened was that around 1995, I happened to be listening to a feature on NPR about John Woo. I knew a lot more about Japanese film than I did about Chinese film or Hong Kong film, but I got very interested with what they had to say about him. He had just moved over to the States.
How was the order for you to see these films? I mean, which I think is very important, the way that you experienced them the first time.
Actually, the first one I saw was Hard Target. That was what I was hearing about on the NPR feature, as I recall. And I went to see Hard Target, although there were a lot of producers on it. John still managed to sneak in quite a bit of stuff with his own style. So I saw enough there that it interested me, you know, the visuals and the way he ran the camera. So then I got interested enough to start looking for the Hong Kong ones. As I recall, it's been quite a while, but I think the next thing that I was able to see was The Killer. And then A Better Tomorrow was not readily available. I mean, I couldn't find it for a while. Finally saw that, and then I just started seeing whatever I could. One of my colleagues, I was teaching at University of North Dakota at the time, suggested I ought to do a book on him.
So I have to say, I'm pretty amazed that you would actually do a book on Woo, having seen Hard Target as your first John Woo film.
There was enough there. I liked the way he moved the camera. That's one of the things I always liked about John's films the most, was the alternating push-in with those dollies. And he really went kind of wild with that in Hard Target. You know, the longer he stayed in Hollywood, the less likely he was to do that. I mean, they sort of started homogenizing some of the stuff he did, I think. And, you know, I guess he was still insisting on using some of that language. So I picked up on that right away, and that interested me. But I have some rough cuts of that that I was provided with, and I talk about that in that original Woo book, where there are some scenes that are really like the Hong Kong films. These did not make the final cut. Like, there's a scene where Arnold Vosloo Pick seems to be stalking Van Damme, and he's just visualizing Van Damme's image, or his not his image, he's visualizing his aura, and that's very much like something John would have done in Hong Kong.
My own experience was going to a Chinese grocery store in order to find some of these movies, you know, back in the early 90s. How about yourself? Same thing? Or
I happened to know that there was a little Chinatown up there, Winnipeg. We were only about 100 miles from the Canadian border. And I found a Chinese video store down in Chinatown where the proprietor was a very friendly guy, and he made a deal with me. He had a lot of old VHSs. He had a bunch of martial arts stuff and gangster stuff, and he would spend the time with me, because I told him I was working on this book. That, you know, VHSs just had characters, and you couldn't tell what the titles were. His name was Calvin, this owner, and I mean, I would describe the film and the title. You know that often Chinese titles don't match up at all anyway. I mean, the translations, the literal ones. And he would look at the film and he'd look at the thing and he'd say, yeah, that has so-and-so and so-and-so. And then I'd put it in the box and take it. And he would take the trouble to go back there with me and look at the stacks and try to match things up. And he made a deal with me so that I could take, 8 or 10 or more, sometimes 15 or 20 videos back over the border. And I would just tell the border people I was renting them and he'd give me a special rate on them and I'd bring them back about 10 days later. So I saw a lot of films that way.
So you braved the waters. You did Plain Jane to the Rescue, Money Crazy, all those kind of things?
I have copies of all of those. So I saw the whole thing. I mean, I saw all the comedies and all the rest. Plain Jane's actually pretty good. Some of those comedies are not very good. I was able to see a lot of films like that. You know, by that time, Laserdiscs were coming out. And then pretty soon, you know, as you know, they got more available on DVD. And, you know, now we can see a lot of things. So I contacted Wu's office and they invited me out to meet him that November. And I spent about a week out there and he was doing post on Broken Arrow when I met him at Fox. That was fall of 95. Terrence Chang and John were both pretty surprised that there was somebody stateside that was that interested. They were surprised that I knew the difference between one Tony Leung and another, I remember. I spent about a week out there and did some interviews. I interviewed Chow. Chow Yun Fat happened to be out there at the time. Talked to Terrence and John, of course, and met some of the personnel that had worked with him before. So I was fortunate that when I went to see John, when I met him, I mentioned some Laserdiscs were just coming out. You know, I mean, they were just getting kind of big at the time. I happened to mention something about not having seen the Laserdisc versions of The Killer. And Terrence said, well, John is going to give those to you. So, yeah, so I got autographed versions of them, you know, the Criterion ones.
It's nice that you're like a professor and a fanboy all rolled into one.
That's right. Terrence Chang mentioned to me that they were going to be shooting the Once a Thief TV pilot up in Vancouver. And I said, well, I don't know. You know, my university, they don't have a lot of funding. And he said, well, we'll finance it. So they brought me up there. That was very nice. So, you know, I developed this kind of ongoing professional relationship with them, just academic one. I have not seen John face to face since 1996, but I mean, I keep up with his office and they are very cooperative about answering questions for me. You might have noticed if you look at the Killer book there that John answered some email questions for me and so on.
Wu really kind of had a metamorphosis with A Better Tomorrow. And how do you feel that The Killer kind of speaks to those earlier films, the Better Tomorrow films, as well as the ones before it?
I think as Terrence Chang put it to me one time, with The Killer, you first see John's mature style. You can see strong hints of that in A Better Tomorrow, but that's still pretty, melodramatic is not the right word. It's still pretty soapy, if you know what I mean. A little bit sentimental. With The Killer, he managed to bridge classical Hollywood film, French New Wave film, film noir, and several Asian film traditions, especially the martial arts ones, and put that all together into an amalgam that I don't think he's really ever surpassed. Technologically, he has. Obviously, he's had much bigger budgets with his more recent work, but I don't think he's ever quite hit the notes that he did in The Killer again.
Can you tell me a little bit more of the behind-the-scenes stuff with The Killer, how it came about?
It's a complicated story, but basically John had gone to work at the film workshop, which was Choi Hark's outfit, who directed Peking Opera Blues and other films. John had done A Better Tomorrow and had done A Better Tomorrow 2. Then he started looking around for other projects to do, and they started discussing The Killer in sort of germ, I guess you might say. John had some script ideas, and they didn't totally agree on the way the story should go. And finally, they decided on this configuration that we have now. It was a difficult time for John professionally, a little bit of controversy within the company there. But at any rate, John had always admired Melville's Le Samurai. Essentially, he wanted to do a remake, and that's partially what The Killer is, at least in its plot outlines. And as you know, he melded that film with the Ishii film, Naratsu Mono, the tale of the outlaw, that he had seen years and years ago, which was a Ken Takakura Yakuza film. And he came up with this amalgam that's The Killer. And he was able to get both Chow Yun-Fat and Danny Lee to be in The Killer. And I explained some of this background in my first edition of that Wii book. It's quite complicated. But basically, Chow was making 3 or 4 films at one time, and they had to do some shuffling to get him contracted to appear in The Killer. To get Danny Lee, they also had to do a little bit of shuffling. So, you know, it was the same sort of thing that you run into in a lot of film projects.
Can you maybe share with the audience a little bit of how you see that relationship between the cop and the killer?
That thin line that you're talking about is actually something that John has in common with Chang Chae, who was his great mentor. Many of his great films, like The One-Armed Swordsman, Golden Swallow, and so forth, have very similar situations like that. Like, there's one in particular that I like very much that John likes, that I talk about most of the stuff I write about John, called The Invincible Fist. It's also called Killer Constable. It's a great, great film by Chang Chae. It has Lo Lie and David Chang. And the villain is actually quite sympathetic, even though he's a mean villain, you know, and that's a feature that is quite common in those Chang Chae films. And I think John saw that as something that he felt akin to. So that shows up a lot in his films. It's a motif that we see throughout his work, starting quite early on. But you can see it in A Better Tomorrow, and certainly in The Killer, and in Hardboiled with the undercover cop and with Tequila, where they've kind of got that shifting personality thing going. And I've pointed out how you can see this all the way through even his Hollywood work. You see that very markedly in Face Off, for example, obviously with them switching roles and so on. But if you look at even some of John's later films like Wind Talkers, the line between villain and hero is not very marked. The Nick Cage, Joe Enders, you're not sure whether to think of him as a vicious killer or someone who has been shell-shocked by the war and you should feel sympathy for him or what, right? And that's a very common John Woo hallmark.
You know, Woo kind of was disillusioning me a little bit for a while with some of the American films. You know, I have only seen parts of Wind Talkers. I guess it was Face Off that really did it to me.
Well, Wind Talkers is really worth a second or a third look. That's a very underrated film. I think people maybe expected something different from what we produced, but that actually is one of the best films he's done in the last 10 years, despite some flaws. I think that one's worth a second or third look. The Blu-ray is the extended cut, as I recall. So I've got, you know, a couple of different versions, but there's stuff in there that John, I mean, that's a true director's cut, you know, that he had really intended to have certain material in there and the studio cut it down. There'll be a good bit of information about Wind Talkers in this new edition of my book. I did a fair number of interviews about it.
What were your thoughts on Red Cliff?
I liked Red Cliff. I thought it was the longer version's much better. I don't know which ones you've seen, but the big, long 5-hour one is much better than the shorter one. The second part is better than the first. That is, you know, the second Red Cliff 2 is better than the first. It has a lot of very good ideas in it. Sometimes the pace lag, particularly in the first part, but it is a great achievement for Woo, partially because personally he had aspired to make a big epic like that. And it is a triumphant return to China for him. And great work by Tony Leung and by the other, you know, the other leads. And John's staging was just tremendous.
Do you ever see Wu and Chow Yun-Fat working together again?
Maybe. They were working together on Red Cliff and it didn't go so well. I don't know what the outlook is, you know, but I don't think they had a very happy time on Red Cliff.
Is there a website for this whole series? Is there a good place for folks to go to find out all the books that are in there?
My first John Woo book is from McFarland, and this new edition is also from them. That's www.mcfarlandpub.com, and they publish a lot of different titles, academic titles, popular culture titles. The Killer book is in a series from Hong Kong University Press, www.hkupress.org, and it's New Hong Kong Cinema Series, and they have a good number of titles by now. At the time that mine came out, they had 6 or 7. I think they must have 15 or so. I just put in a prospectus with them to do a book on Hard Boiled, so we'll see if that happens or not.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
GGTMC. Live. For you, fresh air. Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to the trash since 1977.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Hi, I'm Richard Shankman, the director of The Man from Earth, and you're in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
The second edition of Professor Hall's book, John Woo, the Films, is now available. At least it's available for pre-order on Amazon, or you can pick it up at McFarlandPub.com.
Top 5 Woo films and why. Go.
I'm still a sucker for Hard Target. I know that doesn't come up on a lot of people's top five Wu lists, but I love it. I love what Sam Raimi was doing with Wu. You know, like I said, the first time I ever heard about the killer was described as the Evil Dead of action films. So, and then Uncle Duvet, you can't get better than Uncle Duvet in that film. He is just so awesome. I think they should have made an Uncle Duvet like spin-off film.
I actually made duvet covers for beds called Uncle Duvets.
Nice.
You know what a duvet is? Comfort. It's a blanket. Just a blanket. Why do guys like you and I know what a duvet is? Is this essential to our survival in the hunter-gatherer sense of the word?
A Better Tomorrow would be my number four. I love that one. The music in it is terrific. Chow Yun-Fat as Mark really just kind of started like a whole cottage industry, you know, wearing the long coat. It's kind of like a duster from Once Upon a Time in the West. You know, it's just really good. Bullet in the Head, really liked that one too. That was kind of, for me, that was Wu's take on The Deer Hunter. And for me, that's a very interesting one to compare against Better Tomorrow 3, which was kind of like Wu had a falling out with his producer, Choi Hark, after Better Tomorrow 2, which is kind of a sucky movie, like kind of a really sucky movie.
You got a big problem, huh? You don't let my rise? You don't let my rise? What are you talking about, Dora?
There are parts to it that I like, especially the end of it. Last gun battle is amazing, but the rest of the movie kind of sucks. Hard Boiled, as we were saying, absolutely love that one. I love the guy Mad Dog, who's Anthony Wong's like right-hand man. Who's Oh, yeah, he's so cool, and I love he's got that awesome code of honor. And then number one is The Killer, and I won't go into reasons why because I really don't want to talk about that movie.
Pretty much on the same page here. Only difference is I'm going to select Face Off. I'm a huge fan of Face Off, and I'm not a fan of Hard Target because it's my Van Damme mullet phase, and I'm not a fan of the Van Damme mullet phase. I hate Time Cop. I hate Hard Target. I hate Maximum Risk. I'm just not a fan. Face Off's very, it's like instantly screams cult movie. You know, there's just so many, the performances are just so over the top and hilarious, and you've got that just bizarre sequence of the over the rainbow gunfight with the doves and love it. And then, you know, little known fact is Joe Bob Briggs actually had a cameo in Face Off that got cut out.
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Four, Bullet in the Head for obvious reasons. Three, The Killer. Two, A Better Tomorrow. And I will say that I'm either not a fan of two or three either. And then number one, for like I said, Wu for me is Hard Boiled. It is, I think, in that my top five probably all-time action movies because, you know, you know what's coming. And if you've seen Hard Boiled for the first time, it's like it just builds and builds. And it's like, man, when that hospital starts happening, it's just orgasm. It's just you sit there and it just goes on. And you're just like it actually takes you out of the movie. It's like, oh, my God, is this going to ever end? Like, how long is this going to go? There's a very innocent quality to Hard Boiled, too. And I think it's like a Chinese aesthetic, the sense that, you know, you got the baby that puts the fire out by peeing on him. And, you know, I really like that a lot. So, yeah, Hard Boiled is hands down my favorite. I'll put The Killer as being number three under Better Tomorrow.
It's funny to me because A Better Tomorrow is like so extremely melodramatic and that you've got that higher than The Killer is funny to me. I mean, I'm not criticizing or anything. It's just funny.
You know, I just like the characters better, more and Better Tomorrow than I do The Killer, actually. I don't know. That's probably what sort of comes down to. Like I said, the melodrama is not a point of contention for me. It never has been. So, I mean, I just like the characters better in Better Tomorrow, actually. You and I have talked for a while about all these quote-unquote supposed different versions of the film. So why don't you tell me, you know, what you've been able to uncover? Because I'm still rocking my Criterion Laserdisc.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Criterion Laserdisc really is the gold standard for all this stuff. I think that's what I saw the first time, and that really is the thing for me to see that one. I'm trying to remember what nicknames they call each other because there are like different nicknames that they have for one another in the movies. Like I'm used to seeing it with Dumbo and Mickey Mouse. And then there's another one where it's like Shrimp Head
and then Butthead. There's Butthead.
Okay. So apparently there is a really long cut of it. I have yet to be able to track that down. And I don't know if it's just like the internet rumor kind of thing. Like, of course it's like, oh yeah, there's a 141 minute cut of this. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not finding that.
You don't need it anyways.
Yeah. You don't need it, you know, because there are extra scenes that are on the Criterion disc, and the one scene I remember the most is Danny Lee coming to Jenny's rescue, and it's a scene that mirrors when Chow Yun-Fat comes to Jenny's rescue, and I'm just like, really? They both have to come to her rescue? You know, can't she make it home one night on her own without either of these guys being there? You know, and I think, you know, Jeff is watching as he, like, saves her and stuff, and it just, it kind of puts this, really puts a fine point on, like, any kind of romantic triangle that's going on between the three characters, and I don't think there needs to be a romantic triangle between them. I think it needs to be just Jeff and Jenny, and I, you know, I guess maybe they're pointing out how similar the two characters are, that they both have these codes of honor, but yeah, you don't need that. So I watched one the other day that was slightly longer, and by slightly I'm talking just a few minutes here and there, and really didn't add anything to the film. There was, you know, when they go to Sydney's house, Jeff picks up Jenny and takes her across the threshold like they were married, and there's like a little bit of Sydney cooking breakfast for them and that kind of stuff, and it really just didn't do anything. And like the music mix is slightly different, and some of the dialogue is translated differently. Yeah, and actually there's the guy Paul Yao, who's like the basically like the mad dog killer of this one. You know, he's got the dark glasses and
right.
He's translated as Frank, and at one point he's like, hey, please call me Frank, and I'm like, no, this guy wouldn't say that. And then also, since it's the Taiwan version, they're speaking Mandarin in it, and I'm used to the Cantonese version. And also, they had to re-record the songs, Jenny's songs, into Mandarin, so they sound slightly different. So I'm used to the music that's in The Killer, and I'm so glad that they've never had to go back into The Killer and add a original score, because Lowell Low did a lot of music for the film, and I like that music, but then so many of the action sequences are scored to other people's films, which was fairly common for Hong Kong films. And, you know, if you go back and you watch some of the Chinese films, like the Chop Saki stuff, you're like, hey, they're playing the Conan theme here, you know, or in The Killer. I don't know if I've tracked down all the music, but I know for sure, like, they obviously they use like some Handel at the end in the church scene and stuff, but then there's bits from Chuck Norris's The Hero and the Terror, and then a lot of Red Heat. They use a lot of Red Heat, which kind of brings to the fore the whole Walter Hill thing. There's almost been like banter, like a cinematic banter between Hill and Wu over all these years, because it's like one of the films that I didn't mention earlier is I also see some of The Killer coming out in The Driver, the Walter Hill film. I don't know if you see any similarities between those two.
I guess a little bit. I mean, I don't know. The Driver is amazing, and I would pick The Driver over The Killer any day.
You can see Ryan O'Neill living by his code of honor, and then Bruce Dern as the cop, just, you know, determined to get him. I would say that that's kind of like the first volley, and then Wu kind of, you know, using Red Heat. The most direct thing in the entire thing is that Hill at one point was going to remake The Killer. It was Hill and David Giler, whatever. They wrote it together, and it's so funny because they actually Americanized everything that could possibly be Americanized, and then they did the opposite. Anything that seemed remotely Western, they made Eastern.
That's kind of surprising considering how much Walter Hill is a Western guy, you know?
By Western, I'm saying like, you know, Western Hemisphere. Rather than them meeting in a church, they meet in a Buddhist temple.
Playing on stereotype too a little bit, yeah. Kind of insulting.
I was definitely insulted reading the screenplay. Yeah, because it's like, oh, no, we can't have these Chinese people going to a church. They have to be going to a Buddhist monastery. So, and then the other funny thing is that Jeff is American. Lee comes in and from overseas. He's American. He's African-American. Jenny, I think, is Chinese. The other funny thing, too, is that Lee coming in from America, his character's name still is Lee. So it's like, and they even make a joke about that. So I'm like, oh, God. So yeah, it was very, very insulting. They take some stuff from Rio Bravo, and then the bad guy is also American, which makes no sense at all because all of the people that he works with are Chinese, but he's like the mastermind, which also is like, what, are Chinese people not smart enough to mastermind this thing, you know?
Mastermind of enslaving Chinese people.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it just, yeah, it's really bad. I mean, I'm really glad they haven't ever gotten that thing going. Every once in a while, rumors crop up that they are going to remake it. But I hope if they do, they never touch the script. Because the other thing is it's got a really sappy, happy ending tacked onto it. That's just like, oh, you got to be kidding me. And then they fly off into the sunset. And then, Justin, I don't remember if I sent this to you, but if you haven't seen this yet, I'm going to have to make you watch this. The Indian version of The Killer.
No. I haven't seen it. Send it. Send it over.
I didn't even know that this thing existed. It's called Hum Hain Bemisal. And it is incredible. I mean, I was talking earlier about how Hong Kong would recycle a lot of American stuff, and you would see a lot of very similar things going on, you know, certain shots and sequences or even some like story ideas. This thing, all of the scenes that you remember from The Killer are in this movie. You know, there's like Sydney with the briefcase of money and all this stuff, and, you know, he opens up the briefcase, it's empty, and then Sydney takes the gun and all that kind of stuff. Well, the guy playing Sydney is hilarious. He's got like this bald cap on with this really bad hair kind of hanging off the bald cap.
So he's like Riff Raff?
Oh, he totally looks like Riff Raff. He's the Indian Riff Raff. And of course, like, they break into song every once in a while, but they really don't break into that often, and the songs just really aren't that good for me. I do like Bollywood musicals, but the songs in this just aren't that great. All those set pieces are there. All those things that you remember, like, especially, you know, I was just like, okay, is this going to have the whole scene of blind Indian Jenny with the two guys pointing their guns at each other? Sure enough, it's right there in the film. I was just like, oh my gosh. It's hilarious because, like, they add a comic relief guy in it. You watch it and you're just like, I can't believe I'm seeing this. I can't believe that they took The Killer and made this out of it.
बहुत खूबसूरत है
अजी कमाल की बात तो ये है ये भागता है ये नाचता है मुंह फेर लेता है आंखों पर हाथ रख लेता है.
I was saying before about the whole Hard Boiled was like the emigration story for me. And I'm trying to remember when he made that. That was like, what, 93 or something?
92.
Because in between The Killer and Hard Boiled, he made Once a Thief, which I noticed didn't make it to either one of our top five lists. Which is,
jeez, you think? I wonder why.
Just remarkable.
Wonder why.
And Once a Thief was one of those ideas he like wouldn't give up. You know, he's like, oh, let's make a TV show out of this. You know, it's like, no, don't do it, John. It's just not that good.
Once a bad idea. Yeah.
Always a bad idea. So he made that, and that for him was really like, okay, I'm leaving Hong Kong and stuff. Because as you know, like in 97 is when the British Empire turned Hong Kong back over to the Chinese. And a lot of folks thought, like, this is going to be it. This is the end of everything that we've ever known. And, like, a lot of popular filmmakers had already left. Jackie Chan was making stuff out of the country. Ringo Lam, Choi Hark, John Woo. So it was, like, this big brain drain going on in their industry. And then they've actually kind of started to recover, allegedly. I really haven't been keeping up on Hong Kong films as much as I used to. I've seen some really good ones, like Flashpoint with Donnie Yen. And then I've seen some really bad ones, too. Like, there's one called, I think it was called SPL, that was just like, ugh. There's one guy, Johnny Toe, who's making a lot of stuff. Apparently, he's making good films, but unfortunately, I've lucked across all of his bad ones.
Nice. You've got China, and you also have Japan, and it seems like they've shifted, you know, so there's not much action. It's more, you know, this crazy horror now, you know, so they're making nothing but Asian horror films, you know. It's kind of like the action genre is dead over there.
It's weird, too, because the one player who really wasn't a force to be reckoned with back in the late 80s, early 90s was South Korea. And now they're just like, wow, right, look at all these great films. And Thailand,
yeah,
who is making a lot of good stuff. Who knows what the...
Still horror, too, yeah.
Yeah, well, horror and then some other stuff, too, which is great. You know, like Tears of the Black Tiger from Thailand. And then I don't know if you would consider Old Boy to be horror or not from Korea, but...
I think some people do, but we're also overlooking Wong Kar-wai, too.
Was he making stuff when Wu was?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because he made, like, Days of Being Wild and Ashes of Time. Those all came in the mid-80s.
I really didn't get into his stuff very much because I was much more of the action kind of stuff. The action and even the Hong Kong, I don't know if you would call it horror, but like the horror comedy, like the Mr. Vampire stuff. I love Mr. Vampire.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Let's go ahead and we'll take a break, and when we return, we'll wrap up this fun fest.
What if a man from the upper Paleolithic survived until the present day?
You know what could happen? Yeah, the pancreas turns over cells every 24 hours, the stomach lining in 3 days, the entire body in 7 years, but the process falters. Now, if a quirk in his immune system led to perfect detox, perfect renewal, then yeah, he could duck decay.
We were just talking about a caveman who survives until the present time.
And he hasn't aged a day in 10 years.
Every woman on the faculty would give anything to have that secret.
I don't have eyes in the back of my head. I can't hear a flea walking. I am not in any way Superman.
There have always been legends of such a thing, a creature, not quite human, taking not the blood, but the life force itself.
God has spoken through man to make his word clearer.
You got four men of science completely baffled by trade.
Who do you think I am?
You are absolutely certifiable. You stand alive and tall in a graveyard that you helped to fill? Well, then perhaps it is time to die.
That was the audio trailer for next week's pick, mine, Jerome Bixby's The Man from Earth. Be sure to tune in or download next week as Mike and I get religious. Plus, we've got great interviews with Man from Earth director Richard Shankman and the film's producer, Emerson Bixby.
So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for listening to me ramble on incessantly. So be sure to stop by our Facebook group or our website, projection-booth.com, to say hello and let us know what you think about the show. Most of all, please be sure to stop by iTunes and leave us some feedback and a few stars.
Be sure also to tune in for the replay of this week's show on Jackalope Radio Sundays at 6 p.m. Central. And if you want to call in and leave us some feedback, we might even play it on the air, maybe invite you to co-host the show with us. You can call in with your feedback at 734-274-5904. Again, that's 734-274-5904. Pick up and dial now. We especially want to hear your feedback from our Last Action Hero show from a couple weeks back. Call us up and tell us how wrong Mike was to destroy a masterpiece like Last Action Hero.
Feel free to tell Justin and the Samurai that they're full of shit. We're going to leave you today with what might seem like an unusual musical choice. This is Birdie's Theme by Peter Gabriel from Alan Parker's film. It's another song repurposed for The Killer.
A big problem, huh? You don't let my eyes? You don't let my eyes? What do you tell my mom, daughter?